You go down this cliff, go left down the cliff, yeah. Left, and then just tumble for a while, and then you should be there.
It's society. They work for each other, they pay each other, they buy houses, they get married, make children.
That just sounds like slavery with extra steps.
I don't know if you've noticed, but our two-party system is a bowl of shit looking in the mirror at itself.
I can't wait for the episode of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, where all the contestants team up and they overpower the host and they share the money.
The message of Occupy Wall Street is I would prefer not to play the existing game.
We are a socialist party and there are social solutions to the problems.
Communal lifestyles, I don't know about that.
No one can tell me what to do.
Wow, you're a real anarchist.
Didn't know we had a king. I thought we were an autonomous collective.
No words for you puppets of the West. Communism forever.
God, those communists are amazing.
All right, this is Dan Platt of the Three Life Show. I'm your host. Hey, greetings and salutations. Welcome. This is Saturday, April 20th. Happy 420, everybody. It's too bad we are not doing some kind of smoke out. I'm always suggesting it, but nobody's stepped up, and I'm not stepping up for it because I'm not a carrier. But otherwise, happy 420 nonetheless. So this episode, I'm going to be, after 2 weeks of talking about electoralism and the Green Party, I'm going to go a little lighter, but certainly talk about cooperation and its many forms and the whys. And how when we're not cooperating and we're doing so without structures of various types, that is when it becomes chaos. We like to think, there's a myth that markets are some type of structure, but there is no structure in markets. Capitalism is chaos, and it is society and cooperative society, i.e. socialism and other left-wing tendencies, that is, in fact, real order. I like this little JPEG image, and let's see if I can relate it properly. It's basically like chaos and order on two sides. And on one side, well, order is a branch of a tree. Branch of a tree. And chaos is all of the leaves and all the separate twigs and parts of the branch completely deconstructed and arranged in order from largest to biggest. It's all categorized and systematized and sorted, but that is not what order is. That is chaos. Order is the branch in its natural state doing what it should be doing, because that has occurred naturally for a process of we call evolution. To carry on from previous episode where I was a little doom and gloom about, there's two sides. Can we deal with climate change? Can we adapt to the disasters to come and the slow collapse that awaits us? But then there's the question of, can we politically act? Because these are collective problems and we need a collective solution that requires government or the state, but particularly just governments. And our governments, governance systems do not seem to be able to handle it. That was what I was describing last time. Both parties are in the hands of capital, and capital is only going to be as green as it takes for good PR. But there is ways of looking at things to be hopeful. For example, the damage we're doing to the planet, okay, there's a type of black pill, that's what it's called by us people my age group, black pill, when you basically kind of come to this realization that life is meaningless and everything's going to be apocalyptic very soon, and there's nothing you can do about it, so you might as well be just live it up, YOLO, and YOLO it up. But that's really immature, and it also is ignoring quite a lot of evidence, the science, and what we can do. So what there's particularly good evidence of all over the place is when we stop harming the planet, the environment, whether it be our own environment. So if you stop messing up, or if you work and act and do, you live your life a bit cleaner, and you're not harming your surrounding environment, it can heal itself, especially when it's a natural system, right? But if we're talking about the oceans, all right, and you see a headline about how we're killing the oceans because we're overfishing, we're dumping too much shite in the oceans, And there's the big garbage islands that that plastic is decomposing via sunlight, and it's getting into all the food chain and slowly poisoning everything. These systems can heal themselves long term, but we need to stop harming. We need to turn the spigot off, so to speak. We need to stop dumping oil waste and all the fertilizer that I've described, where we're creating a dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. And here's a story from The Independent about, it's titled Massive Restoration of World's Forests Would Cancel Out a Decade of CO2 Emissions, Analysts Suggest. Now, of course, is this the last decade of emissions, or is it a decade like 1980 to 1990, that decade of emissions? What decade is it talking about? Because we're accelerating the amount we're emitting all the time. So, but let's say they were using the last decade. I'm reading this fresh right now. So this is the first time I've actually read it. New findings suggest trees are, quote, our most powerful weapon in the fight against climate change. And there is also data, I think this was mentioned, I was watching the finally long-awaited debate between Slavoj Žižek and Jordan B. Peterson, two philosophical daddies for us wayward lost boys and girls. But otherwise, let's see, what did Žižek... Oh yeah, Žižek mentioned that, like, oh, he's a pessimist. He's a philosopher, he's a pessimist. He's pessimistic about everything. So Jordan Peterson's like, oh, you leftists, you don't have any alternative. Like, all your alternatives were Stalinist regimes, and that's terrible. So you don't have an alternative. We might as well accept markets as natural or something, and blah, blah, blah. Right-wing reactionary rhetoric. So while Žižek was saying, like, well, I'm a pessimist, I don't believe we have those kind of alternatives. We should acknowledge that we actually do have more forests in Europe and some places where there is environmentalist movements. And there are environmentalist movements in the developing world, certainly. But also there's neocolonialism extracting and destroying the forests there. And the forests can regrow and they can rejuvenate and there can be rehabbed. Yeah, rehab. Well, just rehab the forests, I guess. And there's that work that can be done. And so... I'll read the article now. Replenishing the world's forests on a grand scale would suck enough carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. And they're just talking about carbon dioxide. So there's all the other greenhouse gases that, some of which, like methane, are way more potent as far as its warming effect, making warmer weather and warmer air pockets, which then creates polar vortexes and extreme weather events. Warmer air means more flooding, more rain. Scientists have established that there is room for an additional 1.2 trillion trees to grow in parks, woods, and abandoned land across the planet. That's an interesting calculation. If such a goal were accomplished, ecologist Dr. Thomas Kraver, so basically, and they're also pointing out this is land that's readily like accessible around us. From building wind turbines to vegetarian diets, planting trees, massive amount, a trillion trees, outstrips every other method for tackling climate change. I don't like that sentiment because it's saying we can keep doing all of the bad things if we just plant enough trees, it will cancel out. But that's, again, just talking about carbon dioxide when animal production, for example, creates the tons of methane as well as fracking. You can't just cancel it out with technology. We gotta stop harming our environment. That's my line. Lack of accurate information meant for years, experts severely underestimated the number of trees on Earth. Combining data from ground-based surveys and satellites, Dr. Crowther and his colleagues arrived at a figure of 3 trillion, over 7 times more than the previous NASA estimate. Okay, so with new technology, they have kind of put out a new estimate for how many trees we even have on the Earth in the first place. And then based on other surveys of, like, underdeveloped land or land that's been clear-cut, where can we fill in more trees and how many trees would that be? So we're at 3 trillion now, and we could add another trillion in the space that's readily available. And we probably lost half a trillion in the Amazon, like half the Amazon's gone. Not gone for good, but it's been replaced with cattle ranches and other things like that. So we need to eat less beef if we want the Amazon back and we want that trillion trees, FYI. And that goes for other biomass, like in the prairies. You know, we grow all this corn, a lot of the corn also to feed beef. So that's what right-wingers say, like when they say, like, oh, the left wants to take away your hamburgers. Well, maybe we just want to take away some hamburgers. It's about having less. But yeah, it's there's also all the other vegan arguments. I won't go into all that now, but you should check them out. Project Drawdown, a group that compares the merits of different emission-cutting techniques, currently replaces onshore wind power and improved recycling of fridges and air conditioners at the top of its list. If rolled out on a realistic scale, each of these techniques would cut over 80 gigatons of emissions, while growing forests languishes in 15th place with saving 18 gigatons. New research undertaken by Dr. Crowther has used the 1.2, okay, now it says billion figure. I don't know if that's a typo. I'm going to assume it was trillion before. To estimate the potential scale of carbon capture that could be achieved by planting trees and reveal their true potential. 400 gigatons now in the 3 trillion trees, and if you were to scale that up by another trillion trees, that's in the order of hundreds of gigatons captured from the atmosphere. At least 10 years of infrarogenic, that means man-made emissions, completely wiped out. Again, if only emissions were only carbon dioxide, they're not, so that's a stretch. While the exact figures are yet to be released, he said, unless there's data and evidence of, like, trees also cut, absorb methane emissions, which, okay, I can see that, but they need to say that. They're just saying carbon dioxide. While the exact figures are yet to be released, he said trees have emerged as our most powerful weapon in the fight against climate change. Dr. Crowther discussed his findings at the American Association for the Advancement of Science, AAAS, which meant DC. Full restoration of all sites identified is clearly unrealistic, says this paper, but tree planting is increasingly being recognized as a critical activity to preserve life on Earth. We are life on Earth, too, by the way. The United Nations initially ran a project known as the Billion Tree Campaign, but in light of Dr. Crowther's findings, this has been renamed the Trillion Tree Campaign. Of course, it's just that easy. It has already seen 17 billion trees planted in suitable locations around the world. And that's also strategic locations. Like, so if you plant a belt of trees and forest, you can actually kind of buffer and stomp desertification, which is the encroachment of desert and the growth of desert, especially in Africa, but it's also in Eurasia. We are not targeting urban or agricultural area, just degraded or abandoned lands, abandoned by capital, I guess, and it has the potential to tackle the two greatest challenges of our time, climate change and biodiversity loss. It's a beautiful thing because everyone can get involved. Trees literally just make people happier in urban environments. That's true. They improve air quality, water quality, food quality, ecosystem service. Usually don't see that phrase, ecosystem service. Okay. I guess I just boil it down to just using ecosystem as both a noun, an adjective, and I guess ecosystem service is kind of distinguishing that. And that's from The Independent. I don't really like them too much. I think they're anyway, almost done with this section of the show. What can I do instead? Let me check the live stream. Live stream is going. It's on YouTube at Three Left Show. That is the channel name. Check it out. I upload episodes there as well. Beginning to that. And there's the live streams. Onward and upward. I have a number of stories about kind of community structures and how they're necessary to building that community grassroots economy that we all talk about and having this thing called community that our current system really seems to disincentivize and just by its very nature doesn't seem to care about. But of course, we have an innate desire. We always talk about our community this, our community that, and it usually comes in the form of kind of giving charity to each other, kind of gift economies on a really slight level, but you know, like it needs to be scaled up. It needs to become the actual real economy. Sometimes it's called the core economy of just all the favors that friends do for each other that the market wants to privatize. So this is from, next story is from Yes Magazine. Now, if I usually rag on fluff pieces in the news, but this is very specific because fluff pieces in, say, your local news channel or whatever, they focus on two people And it's usually like, you know, oh, you know, some little Johnny needed a surgery. And they were able, through the generosity of neighbors and a few other people, they were able to pay for the surgery, even though the cost of the surgery is, didn't have health insurance, or they did, and the health insurance wouldn't cover the surgery. But thankfully, Charity was able to fix the problem. Wink, wink, yeah, the problem is fixed, right? So there's all these underlying issues of why Johnny didn't get the surgery he needed in the first place. And now it's up to other people or this basically luck-based factor to fill it in. Because whenever I saw those fluff pieces, even when I was young, I'd think about, well, aren't there thousands of people that need such surgeries? Is this going to happen for all of them? And so I would have this awareness of just like these fluff pieces. They're just showing like one good thing happening to a singular person. And we're assuming that it adds up and this happens for everyone in something. But really, no, this is news because it's just the one person. Now, Yes Magazine, and so instead we need collective solutions. We need to think like communities in solving these things. And as far as, say, like healthcare insurance, single payer is about thinking about a whole state or country, thinking like a community where we are chipping in and paying for mass health insurance and not going through the middlemen of the private healthcare industry, private insurance industry particularly. But Yes Magazine is kind of like a whole news source for fluff pieces, but the fluff pieces being, when I say fluff, then I mean optimistic, good things happening that are relatively small, right? So they're not probably going to impact you directly, but they are instructive in what can happen out there in the world. These solutions, these things happening, are collective in nature. They're community projects. So it's fluff pieces, but with community projects. And so this one is called, These Neighbors Got Together to Buy Vacant Buildings, Now They're Renting to Bakers and Brewers. Though the model is new and small, it holds outsized potential for the many neighborhoods whose downtowns are controlled by faraway landlords or retail chains. Bringing back Main Street, right? When people think of Main Street, we think of a row of commercial enterprises that are all small. Small is beautiful. Quote economist Schubacher. I'll get his name right. And so let's go into it. Written by Olivia LaVicenza, and it was posted this, I pulled this, it's pretty old, but not too old, September 4th, 2015, this was written. This article was produced by the Institute for Local Self-Reliance as part of its Community Scaled Economy Initiative, which produces research and partners with a range of allies to implement public policies that curb economic consolidation and strengthen locally owned enterprises. Okay. The intersection of Central and Lowry Avenues in northeast Minneapolis is bustling. On the northeast corner is a trifecta of local businesses, bike shop, cooperative brewery, and a bakery, and buildings with eye-catching exteriors of rough-hewn wood and silvery porcelain bricks. The neighborhood grocery co-op is one block up the street. This commercial stretch didn't always look like this, of course. In 2011, right after the recession, where these three businesses sit, there were two vacant buildings. The empty space was not uncommon along Central Avenue. Many cities have a Central Avenue like that, fits this description. A long corridor that was created to be the main street of the neighborhood. But that had suffered from decades of disinvestment from capitalists. While a few businesses dotted the avenue, many other storefronts were neglected. A lot of people looking at it is too big to tackle, explains Leslie Watson, who lives nearby. In 2011, a group of dedicated neighbors came together to change that. In November of that year, five of them, including Watson, became the founding board of the what's called the Northeast Investment Cooperative. A first of its kind in the U.S., cooperative engaged in buying and developing real estate. So this is a real estate co-op. NEIC, that's the acronym for that, created a structure where any Minnesota resident could join the co-op for $1,000. Pretty affordable, at least for some middle class and upper working class people. I have $1,000 I could throw. And invest more through the purchase of different classes of non-voting stock. So you can invest in with less. The group began spreading the word to prospective members and started looking for a building to buy. So it's like crowdsourcing, but to buy real estate. And instead of one person doing it, it is a group of people doing it. And thus, as a group, they're doing it with neighborhood values at the front, their motives. 1 year later, they had enough members to buy, so enough investors, but small donor investors, like the Bernie campaign, to buy the two buildings on Central Avenue for cash. The co-op quickly sold one of the buildings to Project Partner Recovery Bike Shop. So they're not renting as landlords, they are selling then. So they're buying the buildings and then reselling them probably cheaper, an affordable price, so that businesses can own the building they're operating in. Many small businesses fail because they have to rent and they have to have all that money and basically have a long-term lease. And usually a business needs 3 years to become successful. And that's a lot more money than anyone really has access to. After a gut renovation, which it funded with a 2% loan from the city and a loan from the local Northeast Bank, it leased the other building to two young businesses that had struggled to find workable space elsewhere, Bear State Brewing Cooperative and Aki's Bread House. Today, the cooperative Impact, the real estate one, spreads beyond the intersection of Central and Lowry. It's catalyzed the creation of new jobs, engaged its more than 200 members in reimagining their neighborhood, and given residents a way to put their capital to work in their local economy. So I definitely feel like this is something that we need to do, because we have a, here in my city of Albany, community loan trust, which provides financing to these micro enterprises. We have a land trust, which does, but they just work in residential properties, and they're always strapped for expanding their dialogue. And it's also about matter, and they lease the buildings while they own the land, which keeps the value down below market rate slightly. But I think we need that real estate co-op too. We need to replace all of the organs of capitalism with a cooperative version. See, collectively, that wealth will stay in our community, says Watson. If you want to take the long view, that's the goal. What Northeast Investment Cooperative is unique in the U.S., similar investment cooperatives are sprouting up in Canada, where they're aided by programs designed to help them grow, as well as favorable policies. Though the model is new and small, it holds outsized potential for the many communities struggling with Northeast Minneapolis's familiar set of problems, from business districts that languishing with half vacancy to essential commercial spaces being controlled by faraway landlords or big retail chains with no regard for neighborhood needs. In the vacuum left by both the traditional economic development and the Wall Street approach to finance, community real estate cooperatives offer a glimpse of a better way to channel capital with benefits that include new jobs in the neighborhood. Now, of course, I need to remind myself as well as through this article that when I say capital, capital is neutral. Capital just refers to the resources to buy and sell things, right? Problem is that capital is owned in a minority of people called capitalists, right? Capitalism is that capital is controlled by a minority. If capital were controlled by a majority of people, that would be actual democracy. Now, this can be interpreted as distributing / redistributing capital equally among people via land rollouts or welfare, or that capital can be collectively controlled by investment and finance cooperatives like these. That's bottom-up socialism. In the vacuum left by both traditional economic development and Wall Street's approach to finance, community real estate investment cooperatives offer a glimpse of a better way to channel capital with benefits that include new jobs in the neighborhood, strong incentives for people to shop locally, and local sources for key goods, closer ties with neighbors, and a return on investment. And it represents a way for these communities to do it themselves. A cooperative which then can create more cooperatives. That is what many of our cities are missing. Several years before Northeast Minneapolis got together to form the investment cooperative, a similar initiative was sprouting up more than 1,200 miles away in the town of Sangatu. In 2005, Sangatu found out that the school district was planning to close the local high school. small hamlet in rural Alberta, Canada, had long been draining people and businesses. For 30 to 40 years, it was a dying, slow death, says Dan Order, but the specter of losing a school launched the community into crisis mode. Order, who's lived in Saguntu for about 20 years, got together with a handful of neighbors to begin looking at what they could do. Armed with a 50 grand grant from the Alberta Community Cooperative Association, so that's the regional cooperative, starting of cooperatives, they began exploring different cooperative models and soon realized that the vision was bigger than a single business. Saguntu was short of just about every product and service that you can imagine, recalls Jeff Singer, a resident of the town. In a video, he says, so we started asking ourselves a question. Is there a way to create a cooperative that would be in the business of creating more cooperatives? In the way that a bank is a business that creates other businesses. To answer that question, Saguntu had to draw up its own blueprints. Alberta is rich in cooperatives, and Saguntu had some nearby references, like a town that had recently gotten together to purchase its own grain elevator. But the thing that they had in mind was different. We saw that what we could do was be the financial arm or the financial support in a way that the bank can't. In May 2010, 22 founding members incorporated the Saguntu Opportunity Development Cooperative. With a basic structure of the one-member, one-vote cooperative principle, a membership share costing, again, $1,000, and the option of additional investment up to $10,000, with this model, their cooperative raised $220,000 in member capital in its first day. People were desperate for something like this. Today, the co-op has grown to 29 members. That's 29 people. For its first project, the cooperative looked at what its own town already had. The owner of the meat packer in town had been trying to sell and retire, but struggling to find a buyer, and thus it would close for good otherwise. Happens all the time, and it's people go, oh, so too bad, so sad. But now, the next year, the cooperative purchased, they stepped up to buy the building, and two members with butchering knowledge took over the business. The next year, the cooperative purchased the second building for Project 2 and helped a new business, then a coffee shop, start up there. For its third project, they raised capital to help Saguntu Custom Meat Packers match two government grants for an expansion. Today, the meat shop has purchased its building from the cooperative, grown from two employees to 14, and become an essential piece of the rural economy there, processing animals from a wide surrounding area and selling the local meat to top restaurants in Edmonton. Now, 4.5 years after their incorporation, it's purchased 3 lots to begin Project 4. Let's see, I have thought I'll get it out in a cohesion way. The thought was that we want better than unionizing. Better than fighting for higher minimum wages from owners, owner class, capitalist class, minority of owners. We need to better to own things ourselves. So any money, any access money we earn from capitalists, our bosses, whatever form they take, sometimes it's the state, we need to be taking any access money instead of putting it into, this sounds like total craziness to some people, but instead of putting in retirement savings and other kinds of bank accounts, we need to be channeling that money into enterprises and projects so that with the explicit purpose of owning things collectively. That is the slow socialization of the economy. You can rely on the state to do it through nationalization, and it's big and it's top down, and nobody really likes that, turns a lot of people off. I understand why. There's a lot of downsides to it. It's not very democratic. You can democratize nationalization. You know, you make something a public utility with elected representatives and all that stuff. Just like how certain corporate boards can have elected delegates, union reps on the board, and thus workers are represented, so to speak. But better than that is then having cooperatives on the ground level where all of our businesses and our banks and our financial instruments or institutions are all cooperative. Cooperative economy. Bernie Sanders talks about it. Other left-wingers talk about it. So, but what does it look like? How does a small group of neighbors do this? So that's what I've been talking about in the last section. I'm going to continue with the story. And this is all currently talking about a town in Alberta, Canada. But there was also the other real estate co-op in Minneapolis. And I learned about real estate co-ops at Left Forum, which is a academic lefty conference in New York. That's in June. I'll be going again this year. But let's see. Let's continue with that story, and you'll see why I really want to finish it. Support helps these models spread. While the town opportunity development co-op has been growing, it's also inspired a new initiative dedicated to starting similar cooperatives throughout Alberta. After giving Sangudo its $50,000 seed grant, the Alberta Community and Cooperative Association kept its eyes on the town as it formed its own development cooperative. Quickly, tangent off, into a contrast where here in Albany we've had neighborhood development corporations, which in my eyes haven't been very successful. But part of me is, you know, kind of in the background, I'm like, they're just kind of replicating the way of doing business that created the disinvestment and created these blighted neighborhoods in the first place. It's like, we're going to create a corporation to solve the problems that corporations haven't solved. And it's just kind of what people knew. And there wasn't a thinking of it should be a co-op. Development, neighborhood corporations or community corporations, but corporations nonetheless. And they seem to be structured in a way that is, in fact, undemocratic. And whenever I kind of bring them up, like, hey, maybe we should go to the development corporation, I usually get that's just the clique. They'll only help their friends. They won't help us. And perhaps that is a social situation, condition of cliquesness and insularity created by the structure of the corporation instead of having neighborhood investors like these investment co-ops do. So the people who started this project, the investment co-op, they're answerable to the neighbors, their neighbors, who put up the $1,000. What accountability do some of these neighborhood groups have if they're not answerable directly to anybody? So, tangent over. 2 years later, struck by Segudo's new model, the Cooperative Association of Alberta decided to launch a new program they titled Unleashing Local Capital to help other communities do the same thing. Using a $1.3 million grant from the Alberta government's Rural Alberta Development Fund, so another level up, $440,000 investment from other sources, the association invested in legal and accounting guidance to draft professional templates for this model, developed a guide to train communities interested in starting investment co-ops of their own, and then help those communities launch pilot projects. Quoting, "We realized that this was something pretty important for saving our rural communities," says Oder, who became the face of their program. As it looked into ways to grow the model, Alberta Cooperative Association hit upon a way to channel Albertans' savings into their local economy. It realized the investment cooperatives were eligible to be investment options for Albertans with a self-directed retirement plan, and that the credit union, Concurta Financial, and the Canadian Worker Co-op Federation already had programs to help cooperatives access these plans. The association now explicitly frames its Unleashing Local Capital program as a way to get Albertans' investments in retirement plans out of the Toronto Stock Exchange, aka Wall Street, and into their local community. "There's plenty of money," says Paul Chabad, who runs the program, citing a figure that Albertans are on track to have $5 billion invested in registered retirement plans. But none of it comes back. Like in the United States, even though self-directed retirement plans are available, only a small portion of people have historically used them. Self-directed retirement plans have always been around, but the ones who have taken advantage of them, it's been 3-5% of the population, and only the people who are already comfortable navigating the financial system. Part of Chabad's work now is raising awareness about this tool for both the cooperatives and their members. Today, there are 7 opportunity development cooperatives in Alberta, and the 5 more are in the process of incorporating. Crucially, 90% of the funds raised so far have been through investments from self-directed retirement plans. The ODCs are engaged in a range of projects from a bakery to a mechanic to senior housing. One group is talking about starting a medical clinic. As the model moves through the province, it also chips away at one of the biggest barriers to having more investment cooperatives. It lets people know that it's even possible in the first place. It's like a barn raising for the 21st century, says Fod. This is how communities used to perform, and now it's like an atrophied muscle. It's painful at first, but it will get easier with practice. Grassroots approach has strengths and challenges. Northeast Investment Co-op and the Segudo Opportunity Development Co-op form their models independent of the other, but the groups show a grassroots nature that has both aided their success and created its own hurdles. For both, a key strength has been the dual role that members play as not just investors, but as customers, and a challenge that has been the cooperative's reliance on the volunteer sweat of founding members. For both investment cooperatives to get off the ground, the most essential resource wasn't money, it was time. Time is sometimes what more of us have. But for those that have multiple jobs, it is something you don't have. Long before the one in Minneapolis has purchased and rented out its buildings, it still had startup costs. The lawyer, the real estate broker, the architect. But the cooperative hadn't been set up to pay for those things from the initial capital investment. In order to make it viable, the early members and the founding board pitched in their own skills for everything they could, from the website to the project management to the stacks of paperwork. The cooperative also got creative. Some of the contractors who rehabbed the buildings became members of the co-op. This is called sweat equity, and were paid in non-voting stock. Watson estimates that in the startup phase, there was always someone putting in 15 to 20 hours of volunteer work every week. I don't think we could have done it differently because we needed to say to people, we're not going to waste your money, says Watson. But for Project 2, we need to construct it so that there's enough income from property, number one. We can't fund it forever on free labor. From Alberta, echoes her. So Gudo, it took a close-knit group of dedicated neighbors to make that first co-op happen. And Other says that the same mix has been essential in other communities and have created active OCDs of their own. You need a small core group willing to put in the time, energy, and trust to get this going. The flip side of being grassroots, though, is the sheer number of people involved in a co-op and the symbiotic nature that forms between being an investor and being a customer. When the cooperative invests in a business, that business also gets a built-in group of regulars. In Segudo, that relationship was reinforced by the terms of the leases that the cooperative arranged with the businesses renting from it. With the meatpacker, for instance, the two agreed on a low monthly rent. Low enough that they could make it even in slow times. Plus a percentage of gross sales. With this setup, the more we could support them, the more they would make, the more they could pay back. In giving themselves a financial stake in the meatpacker's success, the cooperative members also gave the meatpacker loyal customers and marketers. In Minneapolis, the 3 businesses and the 2 buildings that were first purchased by their cooperative have all become successful on their own, but they count their 200-some landlords among their loyal following. Watson was at one of the businesses, Ackie's Bread House, the bakery, on opening day and recalls that out of every 10 customers, 8 were members of the investment co-op. You run into very familiar faces, she says. Everybody just takes a lot of pride in what happened, and I know they go to the buildings in part because of that. Now, you see, when it's capitalist, when it's through banks, bank loans to small businesses, there's a disconnection there, right? We all become dislocated consumers, and these businesses, we just kind of almost rely on a magic, the invisible hand of the market. But it's not invisible. Banks have a logic to who they loan to for how long and how much, and that's based on a number of factors that are not really controllable by people on the ground in the neighborhood or any particular entrepreneur. Some of these factors are racial and sexual in character and are based on biases and very irrational things. because people are not always rational actors. In fact, they're not most of the time. Loyalty, for example, is not something that is always rational actors. So please throw out any neoliberal or neoclassical economic ideas you may have. It needs to go in the trash. I could go the whole rest of the hour with this. This is a much longer article, but I will link to it, as I do with all stories covered, in when I post the episode. I'm able to do that in most platforms now. Bottom lines. While Minneapolis and Sargudo think about how their model can grow, they're seeing the cooperatives build wealth in their communities through both direct and indirect returns on investment. From the beginning, they have both carefully considered the balance between achieving their community aims and offering investors a return on their capital. This question is motivated as much by their individual projects as it is by questions about how to scale up and how to turn their model into one of the building blocks of a new economy. You have to offer a return to people, says Watson. If we're going to say, we're building an alternative economy, and here's a different way to invest your money, but by the way, you'd be better off leaving it in a savings account at 0.2 interest, then you're not going to get enough capital. As it focuses on expanding, the investment co-op has not yet paid a dividend, but it has structures in place to do so, as well as structures in place so that owners can capture a percentage of the property's appreciating value. For the investment co-op's owners, who have invested beyond their voting share, the co-op aims to offer more and to pay out those dividends first. It's a long-term strategy that makes it a place not just for 600 people to come in at $1,000 apiece, but for people to do more, says Watson. We have to be able to prove that hypothesis before we can expect people to do it at scale. At the same time, Northeast Investment Co-op is able to operate in a way that's different from a corporation driven solely by profit, and that flexibility is a critical piece of what it brings to the neighborhood. When the cooperative's board first looked at the building that they ended up buying, they ran some quick calculations to see what they'd be able to offer as a return. The only thing that seemed to make it work was 2%, and our real estate broker just started laughing, Watson remembers, but we said, yeah, we're okay with that. And so Judo, their cooperative, first 2 years brought in some strong returns. At the end of year one, their meat packers generated a 6.3% return for cooperative members. Over the past 2 years, however, the co-op has restructured in order to become an option for self-directed retirement plans, and professional fees to lawyers and accountants have resulted in lower returns. That hurts, but we need to look at this in a much bigger way. It's not an investment for the next year or 2 years. This is a legacy, an investment for the next 20 or beyond. Yep, so that I'll end with that and go into the first break of the hour. Thank you for joining me. I hope you find this very valuable. I find it fascinating. And, of course, just brings to mind, like, oh, we need to do this here, wherever here is for you. Look for the right people, you know. And I think that's good that there are other DSA and lefty meetups happening at bars and other, hopefully, coffee shops usually. You know, there's a coffee with comrades, drinking with comrades. It's like, oh, these are just social clubs. Well, bring up these ideas of starting investment co-ops, because some of the people there do have a good income. Maybe they're a state worker. Maybe they're something else. Maybe they're an engineer, and they have a good income. Maybe they got that STEM degree. But there needs to be their energy, the motivation to build a new economy, to be a socialist, whatever that means to them, can mean these things. Talk about that. And do it.
Believe it.
Okay, welcome back. But instead, in the same vein of neighborhood development and cooperative structures and just doing things as real communities, instead of just kind of working as a hodgepodge of individuals and calling it a community, how to design our neighborhoods for happiness. This is also from Yes Magazine, so continuing on from that same vein. But this is also, subtext here, an ongoing long-term project of in the background of describing and explaining ideas and concepts from a book called The Pattern Language. Because urban design, our cities, our towns, villages, what have you, are like a language. It's like sentences. And every element of a house, a neighborhood, or any kind of design is like a word. Just as language and the way we construct words and sentences is also like a design process that we're doing on the fly all the time. But with practice, you can be better. When we share our yards, sidewalks, and other common spaces, we find a greater sense of belonging and connection to those around us. So usually in our cities, individual property owners are responsible for individual plots of land and individual sections of sidewalk. Here where it snows, you're responsible for shoveling it. You can pay someone else to shovel for it, thus becomes a market transaction. Sometimes you can have a good arrangement where one neighbor has a snowblower and just does the whole block, doesn't need to be asked, or was asked. Okay, this is written by Jay Wall Jasper, posted July in 2013. Biology is destiny, declared Sigmund Freud, but if Freud were around today, he might say design is destiny, especially after taking a stroll through our most modern cities. The way we design our communities plays a huge role in how we experience our lives. Neighborhoods built around sidewalks, for instance, mean that people walk less and therefore enjoy fewer spontaneous encounters, which is what instills a spirit of community to a place. I think I put a negative injunction in there. Oh, sorry. Neighborhoods built without sidewalks, then people walk less. A neighborly sense of commons is missing where there are no sidewalks. You don't have to be a therapist to realize that this creates lasting psychological effects. It thwarts the connections between people and encourages us to congregate, cooperate, and work for the common good. We retreat into ever more privatized existences. Of course, there is no startling revelation to this. Over the last 40 years, the shrinking sense of community across America has been widely discussed, and many proposals outlined about how to bring us back together. One of the most notable solutions being put into practice to combat this problem is titled New Urbanism, an architectural movement to build new communities and revitalize existing ones by maximizing opportunities for social exchange, featuring public plazas, front porches, corner stores, coffee shops, neighborhood schools, more narrow streets, and yes, sidewalks. Now, New Urbanism kind of took a lot of the pattern language, but just like half of it. And to me, it's like, well, again, you're not going to cross a river with half a bridge, and you can't have a safe landing from a plane with half a parachute. To me, I have some critiques of New Urbanism, especially since it's being these community type elements and community creating elements, which counter market forces quite a bit, is being jammed into the capitalist system, because all of these elements existed before capitalism and were systematically removed as capitalism developed, with a car based economy, with wider streets and privatization of various services that were communal at one time. And you see that where, like, say, if any of these things like sidewalks and well-kept streets are, in fact, maintained, it's done by public entities. And it couldn't be privatized, and when it is, it's shite. While New Urbanism is making strides at the level of the neighborhood, we still spend most of our time at home, which today means seeing no more other than our nuclear family. How could we widen that circle just a bit? Cooperative living and co-housing communities are getting popular, sort of, especially among young people. I want to start one, for example. Yet millions more people are looking for more informal arrangements with neighbors, where they share more than a property line. That's an idea Seattle's area architect Ross Chaplin has explored for many years and now showcases in an inspiring book called Pocket Neighborhoods, Creating a Small-Scale Community in a Large-Scale World. So one of the critiques of New Urbanism, because it's actually been around as a movement, so to speak, movement of designers, since the 80s. But, again, it's been jammed into the market economy. It's where it's been applied the most. It's applied in these master plans, in these grand developments. And so New Urbanism with these ideas have been on offer slash implemented for the well-off and not so much for everyone else. The architect, Ross Chaplin, he believes that groupings of 4 to 12 households make an ideal community. Now, this is not his idea. This is from Pattern Language, but he's probably drawing from it. Where meaningful, and the thing about Pattern Language is it works at different scales. So they're like, it would start at a regional scale with these elements of what a region has that makes it more cooperative slash, you know, just better. And then it would, he would, every, say, 20 or so elements, because it's like a book of like 300 concepts, he would kind of jump down a scale. So from the city scale, then the neighborhood scale, then the block scale, down to the house, and then he would end with like the room. And then he's just describing pieces of furniture. Or one concept of the pattern language was like a room with different styled chairs in it. Like a room with like three different chairs, right? Like a cushy chair, a harder chair, you know. Instead of having a room with where all the furniture is like from IKEA and it's all the same, that doesn't bring life into a room, but a room with different styled chairs does have more life in it. And just as a neighborhood that has some kind of common ground, Chapman explains, that strong connection between neighbors developed most fully and organically, meaning it does not be forced, you don't have to organize a ice cream social every week, when everyone shares some common ground. That can be a semi-public space, as in a pocket neighborhood Chaplin designed in the Seattle area, where real estate prices are very high. In the book's bright photographs, they look like glossy patches of paradise, where kids scamper, flowers bloom, and neighborhoods stop to chat. But Chapman points out these commons can take many different forms. An apartment building in Cambridge, Mass., with a shared backyard, a group of neighbors in Oakland who tore down their backyard fences and created a commons that way, a block in Baltimore that turned their alley into a public commons, or the residential pedestrian streets found in Manhattan Beach, California, and all over Europe. The benefits of living in such a community go farther than you might imagine. I lived in one when I was a grad student, a rundown 1886 row house with a common courtyard near the University of Minnesota. At one other time in my life have I become such close friends with my neighbors. We shared impromptu afternoon conversations at a picnic table and parties that went into the early hours of the morning under the Italian lights we strung from the trees. When the property was sold to a speculator who jacked up the rent to raise capital for the eventual demolition of the building, we organized a rent strike, and we won, which would never have happened if we had not already forged strong bonds with each other, because the judge ruled that the landlord could not raise our rents until he fixed up the building. He abandoned plans to knock it down. It still stands today, and I still remain in contact with some of the old gang that partied in that courtyard. So that was from Jay Wallace Japper. He's a fellow at On the Commons and editor of onthecommons.org, at least in 2013. Don't know what he's doing now. Maybe he's still doing that. But yes, promoting commons, which come in all shapes and sizes, even if it's just a shared courtyard, a backyard, just make a larger backyard, and or a community garden. It could be a vacant lot that people purchase together. But still, many of our programs, let's say the land bank, a regional land bank, is still working in the old paradigm. They're not thinking about collective ownership. They want to promote micro enterprises on these vacant lots that we have. We have hundreds of vacant lots. They want to sell them at a premium discount to whoever the vacant lot is next to. And they'll sell it to, like, if you own the house next door, you can buy it really cheap. Like, we'll actually just give it to you. And it could be like a second backyard or something. And again, they're just thinking in terms of like, we just want an individual homeowner to do it. Because up here in my neck of the woods, we don't, in many other areas in America as well, there is no precedent for these cooperatives. Maybe there's a land trust or a, you know, a community corporation. But we need new things, completely new things. At the moment, we just have one food co-op, and it's become more corporate with time, probably because it was on its own. And when it needed to finance a new building, it needed to do so through our credit union. But that credit union is still, it's nonprofit, but it's still a type of corporation. It wasn't an investment co-op that's like, yeah, we want you to keep your cooperative democratic flavor. But then in order to get that financing, they actually had to create a second board, and it became less democratic. It became more like a normal corporation, which then becomes anti-union, and because it's a consumer co-op first and foremost, and not a worker co-op that doesn't also have worker ownership, though there are worker owners. This is from Shareable. Shareable's a bit like Yes in that it's basically like a blog that acts as a news aggregator where their writers basically find all of these great examples of collaborative or cooperative stuff. It comes in many different forms, but it all kind of shares the same values. So this one says, how a nonprofit called 42 is creating a free collaborative approach to education. So this is still like a private enterprise, like a charter school. But their curriculum, and oh yeah, I'm sorry, it's no, my critique is more that they're just like a tech school. It's all very STEM focused. The nonprofit software engineering school, software engineering, 42, founded and funded by a billionaire businessman, Xavier Niel, okay, billionaire, is taking a unique approach to education. The organization aims to free students from the isolation and economic burdens associated with such higher education institutions in the U.S. Aspiring students participate in an intensive training called PITSEEN, in which they code for 4 weeks in collaboration with other candidates. So after a very tough entrance exam, students can also opt for a 1 year so they can go into a flexible, self-paced, 3 to 5 year program where students can broadly explore their interests freely. Students can also opt for a 1 year intensive program, which they call Starfleet Academy, which follows a set of curriculum. In both programs, they collaborate with their peers and co-create an educational commons of sorts, teaching and learning from each other without oversight by teachers or professors. There's not a lot of overview by staff because that influences power dynamics, says Stacey Fawcett, writer and content coordinator at 42. That would make things not unfold naturally at all. The house of 42 consists of a large-shaped open computer lab space, common space, equipped with all the resources that students need. The space never closes, and there are no formal courses. Rather, 42 staff play a background role in offering op support, and they facilitate a gamified approach that students take to learning. The organization's website described this process as being, as they put it, organized according to a dependency tree that the student players can go through in order to earn levels in different competencies at their own pace. Essentially, students go on educational learning quests. So this is what gamifying, you know, they make, creating a sense of play by overlaying these concepts from RPGs and other kind of games that I play, individually and collectively as they learn coding and other skills. And this could be done with any kind of curriculum, I know. It's like a skill tree from a video game where you have the first couple projects. You need to do the basic things, and then once you get to like the third project, then you can go on all these different paths. This is a current student. The model integrates collaboration into the heart of 42's design and practice. Mutual support is not only emphasized, but required for progression, as advancement within 42's system is measured through the accruement of experience points, which comes from students completing peer-to-peer corrections through each line of code around a project. So I have critiques for this, like based on that it's just a coding school and it's funded by a billionaire, but the billionaire definitely seems to be hands-off, or at least the methodology is This is, well, I mean, it's actually what I want. You know, I want rich people to fund things that are just not capitalist. Now, what's capitalist about this is, like, it's just a coding school, which has a lot of value in the marketplace, as we're told, for now. But it's also expanding the labor pool so that eventually programming skills are not so valuable. So there's that to take into account. But otherwise, how this school functions, right, because since it is funded by a billionaire, it can do whatever they want. And they're basically has this free-for-all. But it's not chaos. It is a type of order because it's self-constructed. It's organic. There is a structure in that there can be a curriculum so the students want. And there's the structure of the flow path of an RPG game. Who wrote this? Emily Bender. So in the last section here, I'm going to end with something weird and out there. And this article, the way it's written, I'm going to stop, go on tangents as well here. Mostly because it jumps around a bit between a number of different topics without really saying why. It's from the MIT Technology Review. Okay, so it's called A New Model of Evolution Finally Reveals How Cooperation Evolves. Now, when I read that title, I thought, oh, okay, this is biology-based, right? You think. Here's the subtitle that might tease otherwise. By treating evolution as a thermodynamic process, theorists have solved one of the great problems in biology. But it wasn't biologists doing the work. So this was published in June 21st, 2017 by Emerging Technology. One of the great unanswered questions in biology is why organisms have evolved to cooperate. The long-term benefits of cooperation are clear. Look at the extraordinary structures that termites build, for instance, or the complex society that we humans have created. But evolution is a random process based on the short-term advantages that emerge in each generation. Of course, individuals can cooperate or they can act selfishly, and this allows them to accrue benefits or suffer costs, depending on the circumstance. But how this behavior can spread and lead to a long-term emergence of cooperation as the dominant behavior is a conundrum that has stumped evolutionary biologists for decades. Today, that could change thanks to the work of Christoph Adami and Amrid Hinitz at Michigan State University in East Lansing. They have created a simple mathematical model. They made a model of math using well-understood physical principles to show how cooperation emerges during evolution. So they create a mathematical model, okay? It wasn't like a physical experiment or what have you. So there's point number one on this. Something that physicists and science and certain branches of science, and especially economics, they've been wanting to be more of a hard science. And in their minds, that means being math-based and just using math to prove things instead of physical observations and long-term experimentation. Okay, their model suggests that the balance between cooperation and selfish behavior, called defection, can undergo rapid phase transitions. So it goes between the two, in which individuals match their behavior based on their neighbors. What's more, a crucial factor turns out to be the process of punishment. To quote Adami, punishment acts like a magnetic field that leads to an alignment between players, thus encouraging cooperation. So he used a lot of different terms there that kind of signal a few things. First, that their model here is using game theory. Game theory is like a section of neoliberal economics where we're treating everyone like rational actors in games. It's really dicey to me. It's critiques. I tried looking up, like, what's the critique of game theory? So there's an emphasis of, like, STEM, you know, science, tech, math, and physics over other social sciences. So we're talking about, like, cooperation between humans. Like, that's what we want to talk about eventually. Or life, biology, which encompasses us. But, you know, we're using math, and eventually they're talking about atoms. And game theory, which, let's see, again, are putting models before reality. This new approach has the potential to change the way evolutionary biologists, economists, and computer scientists, because we're all computers, right, think about cooperation and the role that punishment plays in encouraging it. So they're putting the hypothesis or the conclusion first before they describe what the model is. Now they'll give some background. A wide range of phenomena depend on large-scale behavior of many individual actors, right? Society is made up of individuals. Individuals make up society. For example, the economy, the spread of disease, evolution itself, Brownian motion. I looked that up. It refers to particles in liquid. Magnetization. Magnets, how do they work? Just to name a few. In some cases, the actors are relatively simple, like in magnetization, for example. The actors are individual atoms, which spin up or down, and that interact with their neighbors, meaning they become attracted. That's how magnets work, if you ask a scientist. At first glance, the way huge numbers of atoms interact in a magnetic material seem complex and beyond imagination. Literally just think of like a little iron magnet. But there is a relatively simple mathematical model called the Ising spin model that intuitively explains how these areas of effect form. In this model, atoms can have a spin up or down and influence their neighbors. In the simplest case, atoms in a lattice, a structure like an iron piece of iron, start off with spins in random directions, right? They're going all over the way. And they flip their spin in a way that depends on the spin of their neighbors. So, for example, you magnetize one item and then atom, and then all the atoms in layers then flip to, say, being magnetized towards the North Pole to create a compass. An external magnetic field can also cause the spins to align provided the temperature is below some critical level. Metals that are hot enough lose their magnetic charge. So they're describing how the model that describes how magnets work can also apply, or at least it's the same kind of fundamental forces behind biology. How different cells then interact. Cells are much larger than atoms. Cells, trillions of cells, then make up us. So it all just kind of scales up naturally because that's just physical laws and so on. Using this model, physicists can explore the circumstances in which domains emerge, like how patterns where all the atoms share the same spin. They also explore how this depends on environmental factors, such as temperature or an external magnetic field. So meaning, societies change based on external factors, like there's a drought, and then we all have to adjust our behavior and become more cooperative. Can't be selfish anymore. You gotta share when there's less around. The question that Adami and Hertz investigate is whether a model like the Ising spin that explains magnetism can throw some light in a way cooperation evolves. So like, okay, can we take physics models and put that on biology? They did this by using game theory, creating a game that you may have heard before called The Prisoner's Dilemma. So this is a mathematical model, so this is all in, you know, one's idealization. By either cooperating or defecting in a game of Prisoner's Dilemma, neighbors. In this game, between two atoms, so they're putting, this is where like I'm like, what? So they applied, in this game between two atoms, each player, so the players are atoms, can either cooperate or defect and then receive a payout that depends on the behavior of the other player. Players are atoms in this model, apparently. The players receive reward if they both cooperate. So again, it's assuming that these atoms are rational actors in a market or something. The players receive reward if they both cooperate, but they get nothing if they both defect, meaning they're selfish. However, the dilemma occurs between the highest payout is given to a player who defects while where their opponent cooperates. And it's also kind of assuming an adversarial relationship. So The Prisoner's Dilemma, by the way, was gamified, and there's this game, a game show, I think it's in Britain. Forget what the title, but it was basically The Prisoner's Dilemma, the game show. So if you want to see that in action with people. The distribution of strategies is random to start with, but over time, this process should lead to the spread of successful strategies in an analogous process to the formation and spread, like a magnetic domain, an area of effect. Adami and Hintz's work is in exploring the thermodynamics of this process, the condition in which cooperation spreads, because cooperation is more effective in a prisoner's dilemma game. right? Because both sides get a payoff, and no one is punished. They also generalize the system to include more atoms. Okay, they put atoms in quotes, so now I guess they've got to talk about other things. Playing the well-known public goods game. In this game, each player has a pot of money and has to decide how much to put into a public purse, where it is then multiplied by some number greater than one. This is then redistributed to all players equally. Obviously, players that have the most to gain if they all put all their money in. But a single player can gain more by putting nothing in and then reaping the reward after the fact. But then the researchers introduced punishment into this particular game. So atoms that do not contribute can be made to suffer a cost. In this case, punishment has a profound effect. Punishment acts like a magnetic field that encourages alignment of spins. That's an interesting result and implies that behavior can be manipulated on a large scale by the introduction of certain costs. It also implies that the result can be modeled using relatively simple physics. Interestingly, physicists have developed a wide range of techniques to study these kinds of spin systems, up or down, cooperative versus selfish, in considerable detail using models. And also, there's been testing and experimentation using all of these games with human players. That should bring more insight into a not-too-distant future, and it could have enormous implications for the way other researchers, like sociologists, economists, and policymakers, think about the nature of society and the way it can be manipulated in the future. What loaded language they're using, manipulating society, okay? Not comfortable with that. But otherwise, and it's also, it seems to be this one big argument for more punishment, right? Punishment encourages cooperation. It seems like they're just re-describing that carrots and sticks do matter. But then the broader question on the left, or just in our lives, is then how do we apply this knowledge and this, what kind of balance of carrot and stick? You know, we really don't want to use sticks. If we want to be free and have a non-hierarchical equal relationships, how do we do it? And there's a general conclusion I'm making about the need for structure. It's a structure, only structures that people consent to can punish. And then if the punishment is consented to, then that will dissuade selfish behavior until it becomes second nature to cooperate. As if you go to any kind of hippie community or hippie-like, whatever, it is second nature, and it can be completely rejuvenating and astonishing to see how no one, to be in a place or an area where no one actually is acting selfishly because they're not working in a market economy where everyone's incentivized to screw everyone else or to extract value. Even a small business owner has to make money from those around them, unless they're accountable to them and their ability to even start their business was based on the investment of their neighbors, right? So I'll bring that around. So show housekeeping. A reminder of word of mouth is the best thing to do for your part in growing the show and find like-minded people. You can leave a review that boosts up the profile on podcasting platforms. The show is found on all podcasting platforms. And you can share the Three Left Show on your chosen social media platform, but particularly I'm on Facebook and Twitter. Visit our Patreon page to support the show materially. All money is reinvested into outreach and growing the show. Links are currently found. Links to all sources are found in the show description. You can also find a full backlog of the show on the website threelefts.news. I also have other links to related media. So thank you very much for the show. This has been the Three Left Show with your host, Dan Platt. Be well, and go left, young man. Bop, 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 bop.